I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW. Today, a trip around the world. First to an all-night American diner in Mallorca, then to New Zealand to taste the indigenous ingredients of New Zealand. We look at why certain populations avoid getting certain diseases and how chocolate can fight cavities. Jonathan Gold is here too. But first, let's see what's in season this week when we visit the famed Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report, and we're talking today with two of our longtime favorite chefs who shop here every Wednesday at the market. We have Mark Peel from Campanile, and we have Josiah Citron from Melisse. And we mentioned to them that we wanted to talk about tomatoes, and they both said, oh, tomatoes, this is it. We're so excited. The heirlooms are coming in. And then we got onto a discussion about gazpacho. Gazpacho is a cold summer vegetable soup, basically.
Yeah, it's like a liquefied salad in a way. So you need to season it with some really good olive oil. If you need a splash of vinegar, I'm not opposed to putting a splash of vinegar in. Yeah, sometimes you don't need it at all, though.
It depends the time of year and how the acidity is in the tomatoes. I mean, if you could find acidic enough heirlooms, you could use that instead of the vinegar. It's great. Yeah.
So let's go back now. Let's try to get a basic gazpacho recipe.
Gazpacho goes back to pre-Columbian days. The original gazpacho in Spain had no tomatoes at all. It was a cucumber-based raw soup.
Would that be the green gazpacho?
That would be the green gazpacho, or they call it also white gazpacho.
Ah. Put a little almonds in there, I think. Yeah. It's some garlic.
So it's very regional, yeah.
But it's basically, a gazpacho is more than 50% tomato.
Okay.
And then I think you want cucumber, you want a little onion, you want a little bit of bell pepper, moderation. You don't want dominant flavors, but there's, let's say, 60% tomato, 40% everything else, then season it like a salad.
And little garlic, or you want mild garlic? If you're going to do more garlic,
I like mild because I don't. First thing, I think, you know, garlic you get really strong,
yeah.
So I like it mild. But you could also play with it too later, and you can also, you know, put some marinated shrimp in there, and you can spice it up. It was different things. But I think it's important your gazpacho is a little chunky. I think that's really the most.
Okay,
I like a pinch of cayenne. Just a pinch of cayenne.
All right, so the tomatoes are in, the cucumbers are in. Nothing is peeled. The bell peppers, nothing's peeled.
No,
the cucumbers. Do you use the Persian cucumbers, the thin skin ones?
I like those. Those are nice, and I also like the Japanese cucumbers.
Yeah. Those are my favorite, the Japanese.
They have a really, really nice flavor, almost nutty. Nice.
Okay, and a Japanese cucumber and a Persian cucumber, how are those different than the usual heavy green seedy ones?
The Japanese cucumbers are thinner, longer, dark green.
A real small seed cavity, not
very
too many
small
big seeds.
Yes.
It's like a basketball player, a Persian cucumber. It's just a little bit more long and skinny. Longer and skinnier.
That was Josiah Citron from Melisse and Mark Peel from Campanile. They are regular customers here at the Wednesday Market every week and inspired us now to run off and buy all these great ingredients. We're talking now with Marianne Carpenter, who is sort of the harbinger of the heirloom tomato season. And we've been waiting and waiting and waiting, as you have, Marianne, for the big influx of all the amazing heirloom tomatoes that are soon going to be in many of the markets. And Marianne, we're here today with you. I see you have your boxes stacked and everything's all sorted. Tell us what's coming and tell us what we can start getting excited about.
Okay. Well, they're a little bit late this season, but we already have our cherry tomatoes. We have about 8 varieties, all different colors, shapes, sizes of cherry tomatoes. And then our heirlooms we're still waiting for.
And let's just go over again, what makes an heirloom tomato an heirloom?
Well, it's an old variety. Some of them have been handed down for hundreds of years all over the country and all over the world. I mean, there's Russian heirlooms, there's Cherokee Indian varieties, there's just lots of different heirloom tomatoes. So they're just old, flavorful. They're high
commercial.
That's the thing. They cannot really be shipped well because they're fragile skin, but very flavorful, very delicious tomato.
And again, they come in all colors, purple and black and orange and white, yellow, green, striped, everything.
Every color under the rainbow and every size. I mean, a lot of them are very, very big, up to a pound or more. And then you also have some heirlooms that are very small, like maybe a 3-ounce or 4-ounce tomato.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all just fabulous. And it's so nice to make a mixed salad with a bunch of different colors and varieties.
That's all you really need. And then as far as their textures, there's ones that are good for slicing, some that are good for sandwiches, some that are good for cooking. Tell us some of the really special ones you have.
This really is our most special tomato, is the one we call Evans tomato. Now, that is our Italian Costoluto Canestrino is the variety. And it's kind of a lobe tomato, and we're kind of known for it because Evan Kleiman started us off years and years ago bringing the seed back from Italy. So every summer, we save our seeds now, and we replant, of course, you know, next in the spring. And we have a beautiful crop coming, and they're a sauce tomato, wonderful for any sort of cooked tomato dish.
Well, so it's now mid-July, and you're going to be going full bore in about another week or two.
Yes. Okay. Yes. We really have, I think, our best-looking crop that we've had in years. Mm-hmm. But the problem is it's a late crop. So hopefully we'll have them through November.
Oh, great. And tell us what markets in the L.A. area you're going to be coming to.
Well, we do the Wednesday Santa Monica, mm-hmm. Saturday Santa Monica. And then once we have our tomatoes in full swing, we'll be doing the Hollywood market on Sunday.
All right, Marianne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Marianne Carpenter. Her farm is called Coastal Farm, and they are the real avant-garde or the advanced tomato contingent here at the farmers markets, and we are ready for the avalanche to begin. It's going to be a great summer. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
I went to the market last week and, no surprise, found some incredible strawberries. If you go to kcrw.com/goodfood, you can watch me turn them into a strawberry risotto. It's like a rice pudding. Check it out on iTunes or at kcrw.com/goodfood. The Spanish island of Mallorca got a big boost in popularity after the Wimbledon win of its native son, Rafael Nadal. But this beautiful island is also home to an all-night American-style diner. You'll meet the woman who left the foodie scene here to follow a dream. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Every once in a while, I'll get an email from a listener that I just can't stop thinking about. Heather Davis, for example. She's a former California chef who moved to Mallorca, Spain, and opened, of all things, a 24-hour American-style diner. So much for changing lifestyles. She's with us on the phone from Mallorca. Hi.
Hi there, Evan.
Now, describe to us the vibe of the diner. I understand that locally it's referred to as the UN.
Well, I'm standing here behind the bar, and I can see... Hold on just a second. I'm really sorry. Sorry.
No, that was perfect. We love that.
Minor crisis. Let's see. I'm standing here, and I can see somebody from Scotland, somebody from Ecuador, a couple of folks from England. We get a wild mix of people in here because it happens to be a neighborhood that's very close to the yacht port.
And is that sort of true in Mallorca? Do you tend to have a lot of mixing of people, different socioeconomic groups, and sort of maybe the more conservative Spanish folks mixing with young international hipsters? Or is your place kind of unique?
Well, it is kind of unique, and it just dawned on me one day when I was standing there cooking, and I looked out across the bar, and I realized that in the 5 bar stools that we have in the front, there was a Spanish laborer, a millionaire owner of a yacht, a prostitute, and 2, like, high school kids. And I thought, this is really odd. I can count on one hand the places where you see people sort of mix and match.
That is fabulous, though. It must make it so much more interesting for you.
Oh, boy. Let me tell you.
Do you serve traditional American diner food?
Oh, yeah. We serve lots and lots of hamburgers, and we do pancakes and French toast and barbecue ribs.
So is there a particular ingredient that you seem to use up more than any other?
Well, we do sell an alarming amount of mayonnaise.
Now, when you say alarming, what amount would that actually be?
I don't know, 25, 30, 40, 50 liters of mayonnaise in a week.
Wow. So how many tables do you have? It must be huge.
5. We have 5 tables and 9 bar stools.
That's really scary. So they put mayonnaise on everything.
Well, some people do. Like the Argentinians love mayonnaise. They need mayonnaise for everything.
The Dutch?
The Dutch are also into mayonnaise. Almost anybody will eat mayonnaise with their French fries except the Americans. The Americans tend to be the only ones that are horrified by that. But they're few and far between and easily converted.
What kind of burgers do you sell? Do you name them after people?
On the official menu, we just have a mini burger, which is like my ode to White Castle. It's this little teeny tiny burger with its own little teeny tiny bun. And then we have a regular burger, and then we have a great big Texas burger, which is like a big one. But then we've had so many odd customers over the years that have grown accustomed to ordering their own special burgers that there's kind of like a secret menu. If you ask for an Igor burger, you know, you get a double meat with triple cheese and fried egg and bacon and ham. And things like that.
So you name this burger Igor. Tell me a little bit about him.
Igor is a very charming young man who works as a DJ, big into nightlife, goes out and consumes all sorts of substances, but is always, always, always a perfect gentleman.
Now, do you have a veggie burger?
We do. We have a veggie burger, which has been extraordinarily successful. I was shocked. I kind of insisted on putting it on the menu just because I was from California and figured that, you know, vegetarians had the right to eat at a diner as well. And it's turned out to be a big hit, and, you know, we've got some people that come in and they order with bacon and ham, and I think, all right, you know, whatever makes you happy.
That's so Spanish.
I know. Oh, we would be nowhere without the pig in this country.
So I understand, actually, that some of your busiest hours are those wee hours of the morning.
Oh, yeah. Because here the bars and the discos close at 6 a.m., and so when all that empties out, you get everybody that's been dancing and stuff all night.
Ergo, all that mayonnaise. It's like a hangover binder.
Exactly. These are preventative measures.
Now, I understand that you have another sort of beloved, eccentric customer, Angel.
Oh, Angel. Yes. He's about, he's got to be 80 by now. And, he's from Extremadura, which is kind of an odd region in Spain, and he's a manual laborer. You know, he lays tiles and does odd jobs around the neighborhood, but is probably, I would say, over the past 5 years, been our most faithful customer in that he's here every day, 6 o'clock, to have his black coffee with a shot of whiskey, and that's how he starts his day and then proceeds on through rosé, maybe a beer in the afternoon. All this while he's working. I mean, you see this guy carrying like steel I-beams up the street and wheelbarrows full of, you know, sand or whatever. And we have a little window that opens onto the street, and he stops in the window and, you know, says, "Ha, tomo una cerveza," you know, and he has his little beer and goes on his way. But he's a very kind gentleman.
So did you ever imagine when you were slaving away in kitchens here in California that you would be living this complete other life?
I think I fantasized about it a lot. And then I just decided I'm going to do it.
We've all decided here on Good Food that we're going to have to take a road trip to Mallorca.
Oh, I think you should.
Take care.
All right. Thank you, Evan.
We first learned about Heather Davis after she sent us an email. She podcasts Good Food from Mallorca, where she owns and runs the American Diner, an all-night spot. Check it out if you happen to be going to Mallorca. Pictures are at kcrw.com/goodfood. In Mexico, there are usually two pathways to economic prosperity, drugs or migration to the north. One town in Michoacán, a state known for its drug trade and emigration, used neither, and instead capitalized on ice cream to make its mark. More on that when Good Food returns here on KCRW and KCRW.com. In northern Mexico, it's common to see villages that are practically empty for 10 months a year. These are the towns that have experienced serious emigration to the U.S. But Tacumbo is the exception. prosperity of the town is unusual, and it's all because of the humble paleta, the Mexican popsicle. Tacumbo is home to the Popsicle Kings. Sam Quiñones is the author of True Tales from Another Mexico, a series of essays which brings everyday life in modern Mexico into stark relief. He's also a journalist with the LA Times. So great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
You talk in True Tales from Another Mexico about there being mainly two routes to economic progress for poor and educated Mexicans. Tell us a little bit about what they are and how Tacumbo fits into this.
Well, one is, of course, going to the United States. And I'm talking about real economic progress, not just limping along economically. The other, of course, is getting involved in the dope trade. And a lot of folks in central Mexico have done that as well. Tacumbo fits into this in that it is like a third path. People in that town have found the popsicle to be their route to economic progress, really middle classhood in a sense. And in fact, in 10 years in Mexico, it was the most equitably and nicest developed village I ever saw in Mexico. And it was largely because everybody in the town was somewhere in Mexico selling popsicles.
Now, do they all share the same name?
Oh, no. It's not. These popsicle shops are really kind of a business model. And that's the beauty of them, because you get guys who are very independent minded. These are rancheros, really, rancher types. And they make the popsicles in their shops. They can sell whatever else they want to, pizza, nachos, soda or not. And the naming, of course, is up to them as well. Now, a lot of them, because the Michoacana name, they're called Paletería La Michoacana. That is kind of the name that most people see and know across Mexico. But a lot of them have
Michoacan, of course, being the region of Mexico.
The state where Tacumbo is located.
Now, how far back does this go? Who were the first guys to do it, and what were they like?
The first guys to do it were, actually the first guy to do it was a man named Nacho. He's an older man now. The older guys started out in Mexico City, learned how to make popsicles, and from there they began to branch out and open shops. Their great innovation, though, was not that they learned how to make popsicles. There were two innovations, really. One was they began to use lots and lots of fruit, and Mexico has a competitive advantage in mangoes, pineapples, watermelons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A huge, huge, wide variety of fruit. But also, selling popsicles was not what they did. Starting popsicle shops for other people to then come in and buy them was what they did. And they made a lot of money selling their popsicle shops to their cousins and their brothers, and then it branched out to other little villages.
But it was sort of like this really interesting sort of micro-lending model.
Yes.
Where either an employee or a relative would come in, work, get the loan. Describe how that all worked.
Exactly. Most of these folks had no idea how to run a business, nor how to make popsicles. So
some of them couldn't read at
the
beginning.
Of course, yes. I mean, they were poorly educated, and really all they knew was tending cows and milking cows and so on. They come to Mexico City, a huge city from this little town, and there the popsicle shops are really their entree into Mexico City. And so they begin to learn all of that, how to make a popsicle, how to run a business. This is kind of seat of the pants business.
How do they make the popsicles?
With a milk base and lots of fruit, and they have it right in the back shop. They can put whatever they want in it. They can create all kinds of flavors. I mean, the flavors at times get wildly. There's cucumber popsicles. There's tequila popsicles. I've seen avocado dipped in chocolate, bean popsicle dipped in chocolate. You can get this actually in Tijuana. I mean, it's a wonderful forum through which people can show what kind of creativity they have in them.
You also speak about how in the old days, in the beginning of the rise of the paleterias, the townspeople sort of interacted between families as one unit. But now it's a bit different.
Right. And, of course, they've all moved out of Tacumbo. Tacumbo is the birthplace, but then they've all gone to Tijuana, Monterrey, Mérida, Chiapas, all over, literally all over the country, as well as Mexico City. And so their children or their grandchildren really don't have the same connection to Tacumbo. One of the interesting things, however, is that every Christmas they hold an enormous popsicle fair, and all the folks come back. And they all have built their house. back home, so it's empty most of the time, just like the immigrants' houses are, but they come back, and that's where they kind of get reacquainted. Cousins see cousins, you know, this kind of thing. Friends see friends again, and it becomes this very festive thing. They put the popsicles over the lamps as lampshades, and they give away popsicles free to the kids, and it's a wonderful time, I think, to be in that town.
Now, when we see ice cream vendors here on the street, the guys pushing the little sandwich carts, are they related at all?
No, they're buying kind of processed Nestle's and the different Baskin, I'm not sure all the different brands that they buy. They are not related to this phenomenon. In the United States, the only place I've seen them here, well, there's three places, one in El Monte, one in Linwood at Plaza Mexico. There's a big Paleteria La Michoacana. And I've noticed in the last year or so, a company in Ceres near Modesto has started producing these in plastic wrappers and so on, and selling them in little freezers. In most of the kind of immigrant supermarkets, you can find these now. The ones that I go to, they always have them.
In Italy, there's a time of day in between lunch and dinner when everybody goes to ice cream shops as soon as it starts getting warm, and you see everybody promenading up and down the streets of most towns eating their ice cream cones. Is there such a thing in Mexico?
Well, the Michoacana has kind of insinuated itself into traditional Mexican life, particularly on Sundays, I would say. Sundays, you go down there, dad buys the kids the popsicles and maybe himself and his wife, you know, and then they stroll around. It's a wonderfully quiet and sweet tradition. It's very hard to be a self-respecting plaza in Mexico anymore if you don't at least have one ice cream shop. And many of them have one on every, you know, block.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Sam Quiñones is a staff writer at the LA Times and the author of two mesmerizing books on Mexico and Mexicans in the U.S. The book, True Tales of Another Mexico, is a must-read for residents of the U.S. I've got links to both books at kcrw.com/goodfood. We get ideas for the show from a variety of places. This next segment idea came from a 7-year-old. She read that Japanese researchers were finding cavity-fighting powers in cacao beans. Next, the possible side benefits from consuming chocolate. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Wouldn't it be great if pizza made you skinny and chocolate prevented tooth decay? Well, I don't hold high hopes for pizza, but we might just have a surprise for you when it comes to chocolate and teeth. Monica Bearden has been studying the benefits of chocolate for over a decade. She's co-author of Chocolate, A Healthy Passion, and we're going to talk about the magical properties of cacao. So maybe just to start, you can clarify the difference between cacao and cocoa.
Sure. Cacao actually has to do with the plant. The Theobroma cacao tree is what actually grows these football-looking pods that contain the cocoa beans from which we make chocolate and cocoa. Cocoa is the processed bean and what we typically think of as a powder, and which is currently used as a beverage or in cooking and baking.
So what's great about these beans?
That would take about 400 shows to cover. What's so exciting right now, which most people have heard about, are the wonderful health benefits that science is currently unraveling. And this is something that ancient cultures, back to the Mayan Indians, believed. And now today we've got science actually proving what they understood long ago.
So let's talk about it in relationship in particular with tooth decay. How do we think that cacao can prevent tooth decay?
Well, you know what's interesting is this research in terms of oral health and cocoa and chocolate, actually started out to prove that chocolate and cocoa did not cause tooth decay. So a lot of the early research, which had sugar included with the cocoa, showed that, okay, you know, if you eat chocolate, if you eat cocoa, we're not going to cause cavities. Well, now we're at a point to where we're learning that cocoa and chocolate actually have certain compounds that help us decrease the number of cavities and might even help prevent plaque adhesion to the teeth.
Now, is that true even though it's married to sugar?
Yes, they're seeing the same results even with sugar. Now, the current research that we're looking at is looking at an unfermented cocoa as well as the peel of the cocoa seed. And what they're finding is that it actually prevents the bacteria that causes cavities from adhering to the teeth, from causing acid production, which actually breaks down the enamel of the tooth, and actually decreases the number of bacteria in the mouth.
Okay, so these are the same husks that we can now buy as mulch for our garden.
Correct. Starting to create mulch out, which is great.
Yeah, you don't want to go out and chew up some mulch, but that's the part that we're talking about.
Right, and it's not the husk itself that they're testing. They're actually testing an extract of that husk. And what they find in it is that it's got these compounds that are called polyphenols. A specific class in cocoa is they're called flavanols. And they have these health beneficial properties, one of which affects oral health, which is decreasing the number of caries in the mouth.
Does this mean that we're going to actually see chocolate toothpaste sometime on the horizon?
You never know. I'm sure companies are excited about this. One of the new studies that had come out, well, back in 2004 anyway, actually tested the cocoa bean extract as a dental wash.
If we compare it to fluoride, is its effectiveness the same?
You know, in some studies, they've actually found it to be somewhat more effective than fluoride. But you got to remember, since these are somewhat initial studies, the concentrations that they're using in these studies are quite high. So they actually have to get to a point to where, you know, they'd look at commercially available concentrations, see what's feasible, and then you could really compare it to fluoride.
So let's go beyond our teeth for a minute and share with us some other health properties that make you really excited in terms of chocolate.
Sure. Well, in addition to its antibacterial effects that it has in the mouth, what we're finding is that these flavanols, these compounds, that again aren't just found in cocoa and chocolate, have specific health benefits. So flavonoid-containing foods would be soy, green tea, we've got onions, grape juice, foods such as those, as well as cocoa and chocolate. We're finding that they actually benefit blood flow. And so if you think about it, blood flow, which affects every part of our body, could potentially benefit every aspect of our health. And right now, the research is looking at not only cardiovascular health, but also the possible effects to our skin, possible effects when it comes to cognition or the brain and our ability to think, react, and to memorize. There might also be some benefits when it comes to eye health.
Monica Bearden is a registered dietitian. Her book, Chocolate, A Healthy Passion, comes out in September. There are places around the world that have unusually low occurrences of certain diseases. Copper Canyon, Mexico, for instance, has a low rate of diabetes. My next guest calls these places cold spots, and she set out to isolate the factors that cause certain diseases to just pass over these populations. More on that next. Good Food is on KCRW and KCRW.com, and we'll be right back. We've said it time and again, and it can't be said enough, that we are what we eat. Dr. Daphne Miller took a look at the healthiest diets from around the world to see how they help ward off disease. She's here to share her findings with us and to give us everyday suggestions for incorporating some of these healthy choices into our lives. So one of the most interesting things you discovered on your voyages are things called cold spots. What are they?
Cold spots are really a term that's my invention. The scientists who study disease patterns around the world, who are called epidemiologists, often refer to a place as a disease hotspot, a place where there's a really high rate of a given disease like heart disease or diabetes. And I thought, boy, wouldn't it be interesting to travel to places that are the opposite of hotspots and see what we can learn from them, particularly about the diet.
We hear about diabetes these days so much in the media. Is there anywhere in the world that's a cold spot for diabetes?
As a matter of fact, there is, and it's very close to us. Copper Canyon in Mexico, high up in the Sierra Madre mountain range. And there is a community of Tarahumara Indians who have surprisingly low rates of diabetes, especially when you find out that they're blood relatives to the Pima Indians of Arizona, who have some of the highest rates of diabetes in the world. And to my shock, I found that the Tarahumara were eating a really high carbohydrate diet. And I actually went down there to do this research a couple of years ago when, as you know, we were sort of in the height of our carbophobia here in the United States. And here is this culture that has very low rates of diabetes and low rates of obesity and are generally quite healthy.
Now, what kind of carbs?
Aha, that's the great question, because it turns out that not all carbs are created equal. I mean, they're eating what I would call indigenous carbs, which are really starches and grains that look very much like they do when you pick them out of the earth. I mean, even their tortillas look nothing like the average tortilla that we get here in California, for example. And theirs are these minimally processed tortillas that are really made from the indigenous corn into a masa, so that when you eat the tortilla, it could double as a scrubbing brush or something. You know?
Very full of fiber.
Very full of fiber, but delicious.
Now, one of the most interesting cold spots that I read about in your book is in Iceland, where you say that there's a cold spot for depression. Now, this fascinates me because when I think of Iceland, I think of a place that's dark a lot of the year, and that just seems like it would go hand in hand with depression.
Absolutely. And if you also think that the neighboring countries like Finland have some of the highest rates of depression in the world. So it really is what local researchers have called the depression paradox. And one of the theories is that diet is really does play a large role. It turns out that Icelanders eat a lot more fish than a lot of their neighboring northern countries. But not just fish. It turns out they get a lot of omega-3 fats from other sources in their diet as well, like free-range lamb. The omega-3 fats in these various sources probably are what are contributing to their wonderful brain health.
Given that so much of the world seems to be globalizing and so much indigenous culture of all kinds is being lost, what do these indigenous diets tell us about the role of diet in disease?
You know, it turns out that pretty much any one of these diets is better for you than our standard Western diet of the big hunk of meat in the middle of the plate with the vegetables and the starches kind of crowded to the edge.
And can you mix and match?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I do in my own kitchen.
So let's talk for a minute about Crete. We hear so much about the Cretan diet. It's so reliant on extra virgin olive oil. But what are some other aspects of the diet that seem to be particularly helpful for heart disease?
I was really amazed to find out that it was just the synergy of all these foods, the wild greens, the olive oil, the garlic, the lemon, the fish, the tomatoes, and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, I think we all in the United States suffer from our desire to find the magic pill. You know, which food is it? One week it's pomegranate juice. Next week, it's acai. And the Cretan diet is such a great example of how it is never going to be a magic bullet. It really is going to be the way the foods come together in the recipes. And as a matter of fact, researchers in Athens have tried to reduce the magical diet on Crete down to ingredients and see which ingredients are more powerful in their role in preventing heart disease. And they came up with a big zero at the end of their study as well. They really realized that it was the way the foods came together.
So let's talk about Cameroon, West Africa. You mentioned that it's a cold spot for bowel trouble.
You know, I was very focused on colon cancer because that's turned into a big killer here in the United States. But I found out that rates of colon cancer seem to run in parallel with rates of lots of other bowel issues like irritable bowel syndrome and diverticulosis and even hemorrhoids. So it appears that areas in West Africa where they're still eating traditional cuisine have very low rates of all these colon issues.
And what is the cuisine there?
Well, it's lots of stews that, and probably one of the key factors is that meat there is cooked more as a spice than as a big lump of protein. But they, too, tend to use a lot of whole grains that are rich in fiber and a lot of wild greens that are rich in antioxidants. And also, fermented foods play a huge role, not only in West African diets, but in traditional diets around the world. And there's a lot of research showing how important fermented foods and the bacteria in fermented foods are for maintaining a healthy colon.
Dr. Daphne Miller's work on the cold spot diets is in her book, The Jungle Effect. I've got more info on this exciting research at kcrw.com/goodfood. Speaking of native diets, the food of the Maori people from New Zealand are hardly known. Some of the ingredients, like huhu grubs and leaves from the horopito tree, contain flavors that, well, most of us have never even tasted before in this country. But I found a guide who leads people on adventures through Maori country and teaches how to use these ingredients in cooking. He's next. That's when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. Say New Zealand, and I'll bet that the first thing you think about is lamb. Lots and lots of lamb. But New Zealand is also home of the Maori, New Zealand's indigenous people. Charles Royal is an award-winning New Zealand chef who leads unique Maori food tours. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Evan.
Are you Maori?
Yes, I certainly am.
What part of New Zealand are you from?
A place called Rotorua.
When you were first learning to cook at home, did you grow up learning Maori ways using Maori ingredients, or was that something that you had to teach yourself when you became older?
Small amounts. We grew up by the ocean, by the sea, so we were kind of seafood people, but we still had our different recipes that were handed down from, like, my mother, my grandmother, and her parents and so on. A lot of it was starting to become lost, so I thought, well, I should also look at trying to research a lot of old recipes that I didn't know of, which were people who lived in the bush, who came from that area, that rainforest. They had different recipes and cooking techniques than what we did.
What are some of the most well-known Maori dishes?
The hangi, okay. A hangi is similar to Hawaii umu oven, where we cook in the ground. Also, the Mexican people, they also have something similar, which is an umu or an earth oven. What we do is that we dig a hole, we build a fire, and then we light the fire and we heat up rocks. And then once the rocks are about an hour and a half, once they're pretty close to being white hot, what we do is we clear all the wood away, and the rocks fall into the ground, and then we've pre-prepared food in baskets and lined it with fern leaves and put them on top and then cover it with dirt. And that would be the oldest traditional Maori food, you know, that we have today.
I noticed when I was looking online at your website that I saw the image of a fiddlehead fern quite frequently, which is that very, very tip of the baby frond. Is that something that's used a lot in Maori cooking?
Yeah. It grows in certain areas of the forest. It likes the wet, moist conditions. It doesn't like it too cold. Otherwise, the growth will slow down, and it doesn't like it, you know, if it hasn't got enough water, or just the growth will slow down again. So if you have a moderate temperature like what we have now in New Zealand winter, it's perfect conditions for the fiddlehead ferns to grow.
And what is it called?
Pickle pickle.
Say this again?
Pickle pickle.
Oh, I love that. And how do you cook it?
Traditionally, we've always boiled it, like with birds or with seafood, but now we have more of a contemporary style of Maori cooking. We stir fry it, we barbecue it, we use it as signature garnish, I put into breads. It's got a lot of versatile uses.
And do you have a traditional bread that most of the Maori, no matter where they're from on the island, make?
We've got we call it a rewana bread, and a rewana bread is like a sourdough bread. And the raising agent is potato water. And what we do is that we allow the potato water to ferment, and then we add sugar, and the sugar speeds up that fermentation process, and then that creates our bug, which is like a natural yeast. And then we just use a traditional basic bread using flour, any kind of flour, and then we add the bug to it and a little bit of water, and make a dough and then put it into the camp oven and we can cook around the fire. That's a traditional bread every Māori person knows here in New Zealand.
It sounds absolutely delicious. Now, are there special herbs that you use, special ground plants or peppers that we may not know about?
I also have a herb business. And what we do is I have people that harvest horopito. And horopito is the Māori pepper, and it grows in the high altitude areas in New Zealand. And we sustainably harvest them, and then we naturally dry them, and then we grind them down and send them pretty well all over the world.
And what does it taste like?
It's hotter than chili, but it has a delayed reaction. If you put a little bit into an oil, and then you had a taste of it, first of all, you taste the oil, but then there's a burning sensation that happens about 30 seconds to a minute later, and it starts to heat your tongue up, and then you can taste it, and it'll last for maybe, two or three minutes, and then it just disappears. So, that's what we have here in New Zealand. Horopito, it's called.
So, as a chef, with all the experience that you have, you must love taking traditional Maori ingredients and incorporating them into dishes that you might have learned along the way.
Oh, yeah. I make a meringue or a pavlova, and then I add an herb called kawakawa, to the meringue. It changes the flavour to spearmint, but also kawakawa was used traditionally as a blood thinner.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
The kawakawa, is that sort of like a basil?
Yeah, it's like a bush basil. And we have it as a tea or a tonic, and add ice to it. And it's good for thinning the blood, cleansing the liver and the kidneys as well.
Well, thank you very much, Charles, for sharing a little bit of your world with us. Charles Royal is a chef and expert on Maori ingredients. He has a company that supplies indigenous New Zealand herbs to the international market. Links and pictures are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Ice cream is something that I simply cannot live without. I'll confess I'm addicted to that cold delivery of flavor, fat, and sugar that all good ice cream delivers. So who's got the best? Or if not the best, what's really good right now? I'll be back with a roundup on the cold front of ice cream. Stay tuned to KCRW and KCRW.com. We'll be right back. It's no secret that I like ice cream. Anybody who listens to the show knows that it's one of my great passions. So I'm really excited that I get to talk about ice cream to Anthony Grant. He's a senior editor at Forbes Traveler in New York City. He writes guidebooks, and he has tasted ice cream on, I believe, 5 continents. And he believes that the best ice cream is American ice cream. So you really believe that the best ice cream is American ice cream?
Based on what I have experienced and tasted, I do believe that, and with a great amount of conviction, actually.
Yeah, I think we do, too. Now in favor of full disclosure, we should say that you're from Santa Barbara.
This is correct.
A place of a very well-known ice cream parlor called McConnell's. And
yes.
you do focus on McConnell's on your roundup.
McConnell's turned out to be one of the top 10 that we found. Although I have to say that, you know, going into this assignment, it was based really on the recommendations of a lot of people, word of mouth, purity of their ingredients.
So let's talk a little bit about some of these different places. I happen to love Ciao Bella Gelato. I should say in full disclosure that we serve it at my restaurant. Describe Ciao Bella Gelato.
Well, this gelato, which, I mean, I know it started in their little shop in the Nolita section of Manhattan, and I know now it's more widely available commercially, but it's just for me, it's like a little slice of Italy right in New York, and they have a very, I think actually, sometimes a more impressive range of flavors than you may even find in an Italian city. They have like ginger, lemon curd, key lime with the graham cracker swirl mixed in, hazelnut biscotti. They have, you know, a very good classic chocolate, and I also like their sorbets. A pineapple tangerine rum sorbet is one that I've tried, and I love their mint because it's not green. It's a nice white mint.
I love that you said that because I think the single thing that really pushed me over in flavor of Ciao Bella, I had never been a mint chocolate chip person ever, and then I tasted theirs, and I think I ate a gallon of it.
Ah.
Light and minty and
refreshing.
Oh, so refreshing. Mm. Yeah,
basically, I don't think I could get through a summer in New York without it because it really refreshes you, you know, in a way that not even like a margarita or air conditioning will. It's just it speaks to your gastronomic soul, which is lurking in within all of us, I think, and it just brings it out.
Now, Toscanini's has been called by the New York Times the best ice cream in the world. That's really a statement that's like a fighting word kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I don't know about the New York Times. I mean, I was very happy to find that it was in our top 10 list, and I would certainly rank it up there among America's top 10 ice creams. I went to school in Boston, so I can tell you from direct experience, I used to cross the Mass Ave bridge there from Boston, where I went to school, Boston University, over to MIT, not to sit in on a calculus lecture, but to get a scoop of chocolate ice cream from Toscanini's.
Let's come back to Santa Barbara, to your homeland, and talk about McConnell's. I love McConnell's because to me it is the epitome of childhood pre-gourmet ice cream.
I would say, you know, pre-gourmet and post-gourmet. And I say that because, you know, I did, prior to working at Forbes Traveler, I was living in Paris and I was doing guidebooks and other things. And I always used to remark that people would wait in line to get ice cream at Bertillon, a very famous French ice cream parlor, if you will. And I often would compare the consistency of Bertillon, which was quite special and very unique in amongst French ice creams, to the consistency of McConnell's ice cream. And what I mean by that is that there's something about McConnell's, and I don't know if it's the fact that they're using local dairies in the Santa Barbara area, and of course everyone knows Santa Barbara's got, you know, the most gorgeous climate, but the ice cream almost melts in a sorbet kind of way. It's not a filling ice cream. It's very light in a sense. I almost see that as being almost like an ideal because it really is refreshing. Even if you have chocolate, it's not a heavy chocolate. It's lighter than gelato. I know that they locally source virtually all of their ingredients. And frankly, I miss that ice cream a lot. I wish you could get it nationally.
So what are some other others that showed up on your roundup?
There's Grater's in Cincinnati, Ohio, which amongst other things, has been around for a long time, and I believe since 1870, which is something, especially in our economic environment. Yeah, it's impressive, and you know, it's a favorite of people like Oprah Winfrey. Sarah Jessica Parker has been known to have ice cream there and enjoy it. And what I find appealing about this is that they have giant-sized chocolate chips. They basically, when they're making the ice cream, which they do in like these 2 gallons at a time in like a chilled sort of spinning French pot, they pour in the liquid chocolate and it creates these giant chocolate chips. And, you know, who's going to say no to that?
I was surprised that no place in Los Angeles ended up in your list.
This is correct. However, you know, McConnell's Santa Barbara, you know, is there, and Bayrite in San Francisco. So that's 2 Californians.
I think you have to make a special trip back to the state of your birth and come down to Southern California, because we have some really fantastic ice cream places here now.
I don't doubt it. There's nothing like those California cows.
Thank you so much, Anthony. This has been really fun.
Thank you.
Anthony Grant is a senior editor at Forbes Traveler in New York City. He's written guidebooks on Boston, Montreal, New York City, and Paris. I'll have a list of his favorite ice creams at kcrw.com/goodfood. Do you have a friend who can call and you can ask for restaurant advice? Well, I do. His name is Jonathan Gold, and he just happens to be the Pulitzer Prize-winning critic for the LA Weekly. And lucky for us, he's here next on Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. I don't know about you, but I certainly look forward to Saturdays when I know that Pulitzer Prize-winning critic Jonathan Gold will be joining us. And so today is one of those days. Jonathan's here with me, and I don't know, let me guess. Are we going to a Chinese restaurant?
You saw the Alhambra address on my notes. There's a lot of cool new things happening in the San Gabriel Valley. And this is a cool new thing that's almost an old thing. There's a restaurant called Kingwa, which is in the way west of Alhambra, and it's been a million restaurants over the years. C-Star was one of them. There were a couple others. And they hired away, rumor has it, the dim sum kitchen from the very well-regarded Sea Harbor restaurant.
So given that they made this decision, what is this group of dim sum makers known for?
Dim sum? Really? But sort of an elegant style, very Hong Kongish and very influenced by Vancouver, where the original Sea Harbor was. There are things like fried chicken knees, for example.
Chickens have knees?
Apparently they do. It's like you're cutting up a chicken. You've got the part that's the delicious thigh, and you've got the leg, and you've got that sort of bony thing in the middle. And you toss it with salt and pepper and probably a little cornstarch, and you fry it with a lot of garlic.
I would love that, because that's just cartilage, right?
It's just pure, chewy, garlicky cartilage.
I would love that.
Some of the interesting things this place has that aren't universally available, although they have very good versions of, you know, your basic shumai and hargao.
Which are the little dumplings that are filled with shrimp and pork.
Yeah. Actually, really nice hargao. They're flavored sort of subtly with white pepper. So there's like just another dimension going on rather than the usual frozen shrimp chunked into a rice wrapper. And they're good at the rice wrappers. They're very gooey. They do another rice noodle dish wrapped around shreds of chicken and bitter melon, which is cooked al dente, which is not a way you usually get it. It looks like big celery. It's really good. It's a really refreshing summer dish. And after you've had all the heavy dim sum stuff, to have the sort of bracingly bitter vegetable is nice. It's a real palate cleanser.
Seems like it would be a good digestive, too, after having consumed too much.
It could be. They sometimes carry dishes around, and sometimes you'll get things that you had never contemplated getting. There was something that showed up last week, which was this beautiful braise of like pickles, like pickled cabbage with mushrooms, and I could not figure out what it was. It was these tubes. They sort of looked like bungee tubes, but they were like flowers at the end from some creature that I could not tell from just a bite. And it was interesting.
When you say that, that's daunting.
One of the things that I thought was funny was the squid stuff with foie gras. Foie gras has always been sort of a thing at Sea Harbor. And these are little, like, football-shaped fried things made out of pounded squid paste. And in the middle, they are stuffed with foie gras, but it is a piece of foie gras that is half the size of a baby's fingernail. I mean, it's something you need a microscope to see. I would say it's the size of a pea, but you could probably fit four or five of them into a pea.
So that might be something to avoid.
It's a really good squid thing, as long as you're not expecting much in the way of foie gras.
So I noticed they also have congee, which is one of my favorite things.
They have really good congee. My favorite one is the one with dried scallops and pork meatballs.
Congee, of course, being the rice porridge that's often eaten for breakfast.
Right, with a really nice full broth. They have a dim sum specialty of congee made of exotic things. So the last time I was there, I ordered a lobster congee thinking it sounded good. And the head waiter came over and whispered in my ear, "You know this is going to cost $65. I did not know it was going to cost $65, so I got the one with fish balls instead, and I was happy as a clam.
What is the best time to go? I mean, on weekends, it's major slam-o, right?
Yeah, it's always slam-o weekends. And since you get your stuff to order, it's always hot and fresh, so there's no problem about going at 2.
Are they open for dim sum during the week?
They are open for dim sum during the week. And, of course, they have – it's a, you know, terrifically elegant seafood banquet restaurant at night.
So tell us the name of the restaurant once again and where it's located.
The name of this restaurant is King Hua, and it is a 2000 West Main Street in Alhambra.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Get more Jonathan Gold at kcrw.com/goodfood. He's with me on the show nearly every week now and always has new places worth trying. You can find info in today's show, watch the latest video where I make strawberry risotto. Mm-hmm. Download this show and past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Check out the Good Food blog there too. It's really fun. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced splendidly by Thea Chaloner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Messiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleinman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.